Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
So these two cannibals are eating a clown, and one says to the other, "Does something taste funny to you?"
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, an hour of culture, food, and humor to fuel your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from writer Eric Weiner that'll help break the ice. We'll speak with him later about his new book, The Geography of Genius. Plus, later on, we chat with filmmaker Peter Berg about Live to Tell, his new docuseries about the U.S. Special Forces.
Also coming up, actor and writer Ileana Douglas tells us about the time she made Marlon Brando cry. Heather Havrileski, a.k.a. columnist Ask Polly, says it's okay to hide beers. And we learned about the stuff you can expect to find in oatmeal in 2016.
It's a warm and filling show.
But first, let's start with some small talk. All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
President Obama has announced a new effort to curb gun violence.
In Oregon, armed protesters are occupying the headquarters of a national wildlife refuge.
The new Star Wars film is now the highest grossing film of all time in the U.S. and Canada.
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Sadie Stein. She is a contributing editor to the literary magazine The Paris Review. Their winter issue is out now. Sadie, what story are you going to be talking about at parties this week?
I wanted to talk about a Tokyo bookshop that has an interesting gimmick. They sell only one book at a time.
Like one title?
Exactly. They have presumably multiple copies
yeah.
of one title.
Ironically, it's called Bad Business Practices.
How not to make a million quick.
This is interesting. It sounds like this wouldn't be very anxiety producing, which is nice.
Yeah.
Exactly. You would go there and you don't get lost in the stacks.
Yeah.
And I think you could regard it as almost an installation with each title they choose. And there have been a wide range of titles from fiction to photography. There might be an accompanying exhibit and they have a lot of events. So it's not just looking at this one book.
Yeah, it's because you have to have a reason to go to this bookstore since you could obviously buy that one copy probably online.
But maybe it's really exquisitely presented and maybe you would miss it without this very dramatic curation.
Or maybe the checkout counter, they also sell gum, kitten calendars, and five-hour energy shots.
They're not telling you that part.
That's how they really make their dough.
There is something to this that reminds me of this principle. Apparently, the human mind doesn't like a whole lot of choice. Like, whatever thing you choose, you kind of feel like maybe you're missing out on the stuff you weren't able to choose. So this kind of absolves you of that.
It eliminates shopping FOMO.
Although, I feel like I would still have trouble deciding what to buy. Like, I can find myself...
Is this the right one?
Totally still having a meltdown here.
I think you must really depend on the owner's taste for this to work.
That's right.
Presumably it's good.
We look forward to checking it out. Sadie Stein, thanks so much for the small talk.
Thank you for having me.
And now time for one cocktail.
Once again, we tell you something that happened this week in history. Then we have a bartender capture its essence in cocktail form.
It's our increasingly world-famous history lesson with booze.
First, the history part. This week, back in 1968, one of the greatest albums ever was recorded.
For a pretty unusual audience, Michelle Phillippe tells the tale.
Country music legend Johnny Cash always sympathized with guys in prison. Part of it was his Christian faith, which taught him bad people could always be reformed. And part of it was that prisoners loved his music. His first top 10 hit, after all, was called Folsom Prison Blues.
I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
When the song stormed the charts in the 50s, Cash got so much fan mail from inmates, he actually did a series of concerts in prisons. The rowdy audiences gave him a hero's welcome that blew his mind. But cut to a decade later, and Cash's career had nosedived. An addict, he'd been jailed for drug possession and for trying to bribe a cop. He got a rep for blowing off concerts or playing stoned. Now he was the bad guy who needed to reform. And finally, he came up with a three-step plan to do it. First, sober up. Then stage another prison concert, and this time record it. Cash's label wasn't interested. He hadn't had a hit in ages, and a bunch of outlaw songs played in front of criminals didn't seem like a radio-friendly idea. But after months of ignoring Cash's pleas, Columbia Records finally acquiesced. at Folsom Prison on January 13, 1968, an MC asked the crowd of 2,000 felons to hold their applause until after the star of the show introduced himself.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
The record of that wild gig, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison, was a top 15 hit on the pop charts. His follow-up album, taped at San Quentin, hit number one. Those felons saved Johnny Cash's career. And a couple of years later, he returned the favor by personally lobbying Congress for prison reform.
When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
So that was the history. Now, for a drink to go along with it, I am joined by Jeff Dasher. He is the lead bartender at the Shady Lady Saloon in Sacramento, California, which is near where Folsom Prison still is, right, Jeff?
Yes.
Have you ever been to Folsom Prison?
I have not been to the prison, actually. Definitely one of our, I wouldn't say stable, but well-known prisons in the country, along with San Quentin.
That's right, both on account of Johnny Cash, who visited them both. We usually ask people to make a cocktail, but since Johnny Cash famously struggled with addiction, we asked you to make us what is known in the trade as a mocktail, a non-alcoholic drink. What did you come up with?
It's a mocktail called the Blackberry Hill. I wanted to keep it with the black theme because we do have the Man in Black going on.
Okay.
We have a blackberry thyme syrup that we do make in-house. And then the time, doing time at the prison, a little bit of ode to the prison there.
All right, that has to be my favorite ingredient because I love bad puns.
So it's a blackberry thyme syrup, a little bit of lemon juice, and some ginger beer with some vanilla Angostura just to add some extra darkness over the top of the cocktail.
So you named this drink the Blackberry Hill. Tell me, why did you decide to name it after a hill?
The hill on the end of Blackberry Hill is a reference to my favorite Johnny Cash song called Cocaine Blues. He references getting into a little bit of trouble with the sheriff of Jericho Hill.
Oh, right.
Which is what brings us full circle there.
Gotcha.
We have a lot of country-themed blues-style bands that come play here. So it's definitely a cash-friendly household.
All right, so you're a music venue at the Shady Lady as well.
Yes, Wednesday through Sunday nights.
So do the crowds get as rowdy as they did in Folsom Prison? Like, do people start hooting and hollering and such?
Yeah, when it's not the three-piece jazz set I got playing on Sunday, but on a Saturday night, it gets a little raucous around the house, I would say. Yeah.
Well, I bet you if a three-piece jazz set played a prison, that audience would also be kind of mellow, and they would probably just snap their fingers instead of cheering.
Yeah.
Late in the hot joints, taking the pill, and walked the sheriff from Jericho Hill. He said, "Well, Ely, your name is not Jack Brown. You're the dirty hack that shot your woman down."
So, Rico, Johnny Cash first performed at San Quentin in the 1950s.
Okay.
And one of the inmates there was a burglar named Merle Haggard.
What?
And that's not a coincidence. It's the Merle Haggard. After he saw Cash play, he decided to shape up and become a musician.
And now he is a country music legend. That was
one of the best.
That was a good stay in jail for him. and just another reason to raise a mocktail to the ghost of Johnny Cash, ladies and gentlemen. The recipe is at our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
For to go my bail, they slapped my dieter carcass in that county jail.
And now we move from music to different music. This is the soundtrack in which a great musician DJs your dinner party.
And on deck today is rapper Terrence Thornton, better known as Pusha T.
Yes.
He was half of the iconic rap duo Clips. Kanye West recently appointed him president of his record label, Good Music. And he's got a new solo album called Darkest Before Dawn.
Here he is with songs and one drink recommendation.
How you doing? My name is Terrence Pusha T. Thornton. And this is my dinner party soundtrack.
Wait till I give my money right.
My first song that I would play at the dinner party would be paying homage to the founder of Good Music, Kanye West, and it would be my favorite song from him, which is entitled Can't Tell Me Nothing.
The whole much is given, much is tested. Get arrested, guess until he get the message.
The whole premise of Can't Tell Me Nothing is the attitude. Like, when I'm on a mission to try to win something, you can't stop me. And what sticks in my head most is just the repetitive chorus. Nah, you can't tell me nothing. It's just the most cockiest display. It just reeked of passion.
You can't tell me nothing.
But one thing that would impress people about Kanye is his actual fandom of music as a whole. His music, you know, the music of his peers. He's really in tune with what's going on. So, you know, being in a party situation with him, man, he turns up. The dinner party is definitely at my house. I have a beautiful place in Maryland. And we're on the rooftop right now. Everybody's dancing. And we definitely stand up all night long till the sunrise. So I'd have to say that my next song is a forefather in the R&B game. His name is Teddy Riley. Groovy. He was part of a group called Guy. The song title is Groove Me. Teddy Riley is known for a musical style called New Jack Swing. Up-tempo, upbeat, hip-hop and R&B infused, jazz infused, and all about dancing. Come on, baby. He built a studio in Virginia Beach, and we would go there attempting to secure a record deal. You know, I spent the earlier days of trying to get into the music industry getting kicked off of his property by his security. We were probably interrupting an amazing Michael Jackson session or Jay-Z or anybody of that magnitude at that time. By this time at the party, everyone would have a few shots of De Leon tequila. Shout out to Puff. And the next song would have to be Justin Timberlake, Like I Love You. Listen. I kinda noticed something one night in your colorful face. Me and my brother were on this together, which is another reason why I would play this. Justin Timberlake was just becoming a solo artist. He was a fan of our record Grindin'. And he thought it would be a great idea if we all collaborated on a song. And Like I Love You was that song. Ma, what you wanna do? I'm in front of you. Grab a friend, see, I can have fun with you. Man, Justin and his high notes. Justin's high notes were like incredible. But me personally, I could never hit those high notes myself. We started with hardcore hip-hop, you know, with Kanye West, and we're bringing it back full circle with Untouchable by myself, Pusha T. Untouchable, uncrushable, running in a 600, running in a 600. Yeah. The song is about feeling like you're untouchable lyrically. It's all about separating yourself from the pack and let everybody know that, hey, man, you know, I'm something different. Moo told me to switch styles. He just came home from the feds like a mistrial. He tells me I miss out on all that club money. I don't bounce. Adidas gave me a million and that don't bounce. The president of good music has been announced.
A dinner party soundtrack courtesy of Pusha T. His new album is called King Push, Darkest Before Dawn, The Prelude.
And folks, that is just the prelude to more great stuff on the way in this show. Stick around for our chat with actor and director Peter Berg.
When the dinner party download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the arts and leisure section of public radio. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. Coming up, actress and writer Ileana Douglas tells the ultimate fangirl story. And later, author Eric Weiner explains why I'm a genius. Can't wait for that part.
I can't wait for that either.
But first, let's meet our guest of honor.
All right. And this week, it's Peter Berg. As an actor, he starred in the TV series Chicago Hope and in dozens of films, but he's also become a major filmmaker. He directed Friday Night Lights, which he developed into the beloved TV series, and he helmed last year's acclaimed thriller Lone Survivor, about a Navy SEAL team in Afghanistan.
Berg's father was a Marine, and he continues his fascination with the military as executive producer of a new documentary series for the History Channel. It's called Live to Tell, and it features interviews with special operations soldiers about their battles in Afghanistan and Iraq. When we spoke, I asked Peter if one of the soldiers made a particular impression.
Well, there's in the first episode, there's a Navy SEAL named Jocko. I had the privilege of meeting Jocko when I was doing research for Lone Survivor. And he's just, you know, quite simply the most intense, righteous, and badass human being I've ever met in my life. Hmm. I mean, all these guys I find to be remarkable, but Jocko's got a particular uniqueness about him that I think anyone that sees it will be taken by.
Is he the guy that starts the program?
Yes.
Yeah, he has the first line in the show.
Yes.
Sometimes I get asked, what does it take to win? And that is will. You have to have the will to kill. Because you cannot win without killing the enemy. And the other side of that coin is that you have to have the will to die. If you're going to go to war, you've got to make sure that you have those two types of will in the deepest part of your soul.
The will to kill and the will to die.
Yes, that's Jocko.
And to some extent, everyone interviewed on this show shares that creed. Did you find something that all these guys had in common that would lead them to such a kind of extreme mode of thinking and living?
Most of them either came up with family members who were in the military, brothers and fathers that served, and they were just put in that mindset early on. Others were just deeply competitive, you know, whether they were football players or they were hockey players. There was a very competitive chip in their psyche that has led them to wanting to test themselves and, you know, the ultimate test, which is the military.
Although there was one guy, there's a dude, I'm sure you get asked about this all the time. It's a great moment, actually. The guy is laughing as he says it. But he says that he got into the military because he saw a scene in the movie.
Con Air.
Con Air.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that might have been a reason. I have to watch Con Air again because I don't even remember the scene he references, but I sure laughed.
He says he sees somebody kicking butt in Con Air who's a ranger, and he's like, I want to be a ranger.
Right. So it's one thing to see the film and say, okay, I want to be a ranger, but it's another thing to actually follow through. You know, I'm sure 2 months into his ranger training, when he'd been up for 5 days and was like deep in his own personal hell, that he was not thinking much about Con Air, and that there were there were other elements of his character that rose up beyond being a film fan.
I'm sure that that's true. Although it is interesting. There's that example, the Con Air example. There's also the fact that in the first episode of the series, a lot of the guys refer to their enemies in Iraq as the bad guys, which is kind of a movie term as well. You know, the bad guys that you're fighting. In talking to these soldiers, did you maybe realize the power you have as a filmmaker to influence people with the way that you portray war?
Yes. Yes. I mean, there's no question that the military is very interested in Hollywood and trying to use Hollywood as effectively as they can to make sure they're getting their numbers.
Do you think about that, though, when you're making these movies? It's like, am I making an ad for the Army?
I mean, I don't think about trying to help the Army increase their numbers. I do think about telling the truth. I've had lots of young men in particular come up to me and say that they are applying to the Naval Academy after seeing Lone Survivor. Hmm. You know, I have mixed feelings. I certainly don't want to be responsible for somebody losing their lives. But, you know, I do believe the U.S. military is important. And if a film that I'm a part of or a television show that I'm a part of is responsible for convincing someone to join the military, I want to make sure that our politicians know what they're talking about and have really thought it out. And there's damn good reason to send them into harm's way.
I want to ask you one question, if I may, about Friday Night Lights.
Sure.
Looking back, that was one of the first series that people binged on.
I know.
Very curious to hear your take on TV as a medium now in 2016. Do you feel like you changed it?
Well, I don't know that we changed it, but I am aware of the fact that tens of millions of people watch Friday Night Lights in, you know, 8-day bursts where they weren't sleeping and they were neglecting their children and they probably weren't eating well. And I wish some of those people had watched it when it was on the air, because we probably would have had much bigger ratings. I don't know how healthy it is. I can't speak to the long-term effects of binge watching
on our culture.
But if Friday Night Lights was one of the original binge watch shows, I'm in part responsible, and I'm not going to apologize for it.
No one's asking you to, sir. Here's a couple of questions that we ask everyone on the show.
Okay.
Question number one is, if we were to meet you at a dinner party, what question would you least like to be asked?
Weren't you an actor, and what shows did you plan?
What shows did you plan?
Because that's what they always ask me. What shows did you plan? And then I'll
what
list
does that
the
mean?
Shows. I'm not even sure. I think it means what shows did I act in? But basically, people will recognize me because I used to act.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're either confusing me. They think I'm Ethan Hawke, and I have to spend a lot of time doing everything I can to prove that I'm not Ethan Hawke.
I never would have made that connection, but it's true. Well, there's a little Ethan Hawke in you.
Or they've actually seen me in a film, but they don't remember which one, so they'll make me list every film I ever acted in. So I basically run out of movies.
Yeah.
And then I'll generally walk away annoyed.
All right. So we'll keep that to ourselves next time we meet you at a party.
Please.
The second question is, it's more of an order, really. Tell us something we don't know.
Well, I'm a big New York Giants fan, and I don't know when this is going to air, but Tom Coughlin is resigning today. He's probably secretly been fired, but he's officially resigning. And I think that's a big mistake. I think we should keep Coughlin for a couple more years. He's the oldest coach in the NFL. You should read up on him. He's a great man. And he's brought us two Super Bowls in the last 10 years. I'm a big fan of him.
And yet you feel that he's being fired perhaps a little too soon.
A little prematurely, yes.
And your opinion matters, of course, because a couple of years ago you directed the opening sequence for Monday Night Football.
I sure did. That's one of my most proud moments. I was asked to create a new opening for Monday Night Football.
Darth Vader is in that.
He sure is. So before J.J. Abrams brought Star Wars back, I brought Darth Vader back in the Monday Night Football opening.
Yes, it's all because of you.
Yeah, that's right.
Peter Berg, executive producer of the new military documentary series Live to Tell. It premieres Sunday on the History Channel.
And J.J. Abrams, if you want to thank Peter for his help, just send us an email. It's dinnerparty@americanpublicmedia.org, and we'll pass it along.
You're welcome.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
Actress Ileana Douglas has starred in films like To Die For and Cape Fear, but she also talks about films in specials on Turner Classic Movies. Her new book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, is half memoir, half love letter to the movies. Today we overhear her tell a tale of a dinner party we wish we'd attended.
Hi, my name is Ileana Douglas, and this is a story about me getting to meet one of my idols. Everybody asks you, who did you most want to meet in your life? And I say, oh, I met him. So I was doing a movie called Wedding Bell Blues, very low budget movie in LA. And I was in a relationship with Martin Scorsese, and he was coming out to Hollywood to win a humanitarian award, John Huston Award. I went to meet Marty at the Beverly Wilshire, and he surprised me by saying, guess who we're going to meet tomorrow? Marlon Brando's coming over for lunch. I just thought, no. Everything that I want to be as an actor is because of Marlon Brando. I had posters of him on my wall. We studied him in acting school. There's no way I can meet Marlon Brando. I can't meet him. Marty assured me, you'll be fine. And then we proceeded to go to this award show, and I brought my autograph book. Now, they were hustling Marty out of there after the awards, and in the hubbub, I left my precious book on the table. When I went back for it, it was gone, and I was devastated. It comes to the morning. I'm really incredibly nervous, and the door opens, and there's Marlon Brando. His eyes were this deep sapphire blue, a color I'd never seen before, which was arresting enough. But astonishingly, they matched the color of the blue velour sweatsuit that he was wearing. And I thought, Marlon Brando is wearing a blue velour sweatsuit? Who made that for him? Who owns that much velour? He said very quietly to Marty, how do I look? And Marty said, you'd look fantastic, Marlon. Marty was always a better actor than I was. So he comes in. And that's when I heard Marlon Brando say, "Stop everything. Look at your feet." And we all looked down at my feet, which were inverted towards each other and kind of pigeon-toed. And he said, "That's a sign of insecurity. Why should you be insecure?" And suddenly, tears are streaming down my face. And Marty started to laugh, like, really nervously, like, "Oh, she's a very emotional kid." He kind of put his arm around me, like, you know, "Hey, pull yourself together," in front of Marlon Brando. And he said, "My dear girl, what is it?" And there was this rumbling inside of my core, and I couldn't stop myself. And I said, "I'm sorry, but this is really emotional for me. I mean, you're Marlon Brando, and everything I do or want to do or be is because of you. And I guess I am insecure." Suddenly, Brando's eyes were locked with mine, and he said, "My God, you're a tuning fork. Now I'm crying." And Marty comes running in with a Kleenex, and then now he starts to explain how I lost my autograph book and it was all his fault and he feels so bad. And now Marty starts to cry. And all of a sudden, you know, Brando says, "Let's order lunch up here." You know, I always like to say, Marty and I ordered the regular menu and Brando the Henry VIII menu because it was, you know, shrimp cocktail, pasta, steak, lots of wine, burgers, fries, ice cream, cookies, more wine. And it was a bacchanalian feast. And of course, the afternoon turned into night. We talked about his relationships with women and his island, of course, and another crazy scheme he had of collecting electricity from electric eels in his pool. I mean, we were under the spell. It was just an incredible lesson to be yourself and to be taught that by the world's greatest actor is something that I've never forgotten. So Marty goes back to New York, and I get a call from his assistant saying that Marlon Brando has asked for my address. I got back to my hotel, and there was the largest bushel of roses I'd ever seen in my life. There must have been over 100 roses from Marlon Brando, and an invitation to have lunch with him at his house. And of course, I was immediately going to do that because I thought, wow, this is going to be amazing. You know, I'll get to see these electric eels. But the assistant who worked for Marty said, "There's just no way you can do this. It means he wants to have sex with you." And of course, I was like, no. But that kind of got in my head. And I reluctantly turned down the invitation to go have lunch. That is my biggest show business regret. I'm sorry, Marlon Brando. I'm really sorry.
Ileana Douglas. That tale comes from her new memoir, I Blame Dennis Hopper, and other stories from a life lived in and out of the movies. By the way, Ileana also gave us a little postscript about how and why she came to own Brando's Driftwood collection. I'm not making that up. Check it out at dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now the main course, the part of the show where we talk about food.
Yes, Enrico, it's a new year.
Hooray.
But my eating habits are pretty much the same.
Okay.
Peanut butter toast for breakfast, sandwich for lunch, and then for dinner it's hummus and a bottle of wine.
That sounds boring.
Well,
to me.
It is crunchy peanut butter.
Oh, well then.
Yeah, it's got a fun picture on it. But listen, if you're looking for more of a thrill, Bon Appetit magazine's New Year's issue is full of new trends emerging in the food world.
All right.
In fact, the other day I stopped by their office and met with their food director, Carla Music, and she first told me about what seems like a less than thrilling trend, the oatmeal comeback.
The new stuff in oatmeal is really connected to the grain bowl phenomenon, rice bowl phenomenon, mm-hmm. sort of like instead of having sandwiches now, we want to build this healthy plant-based diet with grains and grain salads. And I think chefs really love to take something familiar and make it weird as a way to entice you.
Yeah.
So taking something like oatmeal, which everybody has an idea of what that is and is you know, attached to it and gets it, but then putting a fried egg on top of it or stirring cheese into it at the end or making it spicy.
Yeah, so what kind of stuff have you guys been
seeing? All of those kinds of things. Yeah. And beyond oatmeal, sort of combining different grains. So oatmeal and quinoa cooked together or barley and, you know, farro as a breakfast cereal. So, you know, really thinking of oatmeal as one of those oats, as one of those grains, and taking it in a more savory direction.
My problem with oatmeal is unless you have protein in it, it really doesn't give you much fuel. Like, to me, you just eat it and then you're hungry in like an hour.
I think, I mean, there is some protein in oats.
Okay.
But if you add, you know, dairy or an egg or even some, you know, sweet and salty bacon, you will stay fuller longer for sure.
I thought that we learned last year we're not supposed to eat that much bacon.
Oh yeah, we're not. One or two slices, though. I'm not saying every day.
Okay.
It's just an option.
So oatmeal 2.0, one of the trends you're seeing. The one that caught my eye, I'd never heard about, and tell me if I'm pronouncing this correctly, is koji.
Believe so. You're saying
what,
it right.
What is koji?
So koji is Japanese rice that's been inoculated with a very specific kind of mold. So basically it's purposely sort of like the way blue cheese is, you know, cheese that's been inoculated with mold. Yeah. Similarly, the rice is inoculated with this mold.
So they kind of put this mold in it, and then what does that do to the rice?
It changes the flavor, and it gives it what is known as umami, so the fifth taste, which is like savory or, you know, often described as like having a depth or some kind of complexity of flavor.
A rich Parmesan taste.
Parmesan, kind of that mushrooms, aged meat. Those are, you know, usually like that gives you that tomatoes have a lot of
umami. So this infuses rice with that kind of flavor.
Exactly. But it's not, you know, it sounds like because you're saying mold and like most people think like, you know, mold has such a strong, gross flavor. Blue cheese can be so strong, but it's actually very, it's like a sweet and light flavor, but it's what is the backbone of all these other basic Japanese seasonings that everybody's familiar with. Like miso and mirin and even soy sauce all have that, the koji behind them.
So can you buy it already? Can you buy koji'd rice?
You can buy the koji'd rice, which I really honestly wouldn't, I think most people at home wouldn't know what to do with, and I certainly wouldn't myself. But you can buy, it's labeled Shio Koji, S-H-I-O Koji, and it's kind of like a more liquidy miso, the texture of it.
Oh, okay, okay.
And that you can buy, and you can add it into soups. You
can marinade for chicken, something like that?
Yeah, you can marinate chicken in it. It's really nice as a way of curing fish. And it's sweet and it's salty, but it also has that depth of flavor, that umami flavor.
The mold in my bathroom.
Not the same.
Not the same.
But again,
but are we going to discover in a year or two that I could have been rubbing my scallops in there? And,
it's very possible.
So you guys have like about a dozen trends.
Yep.
What's one that kind of
I mean, one that a favorite of mine is actually this turmeric trend. So turmeric is a rhizome.
Which
like
it's
ginger.
A root.
It's a root.
Okay.
But I think technically, I just like the word rhizome.
Rhizome is a good word.
Yeah. So it's got that same kind of shape as ginger and actually a similar flavor, but it's sort of much more earthy and it's got this really intense, beautiful, bright orange color.
So traditionally it was dried and added into curries, right?
Yeah, it's really like any Indian yellow curry, even some Spanish rice would get color from turmeric.
Yeah.
But it's also touted, you know, back to all this like healthy stuff. It's touted for its anti-inflammatory properties and it's now you can go to juice shops and you'll see it blended into smoothies. It's being juiced fresh into like if you have a carrot, turmeric juice is just going to have this like kryptonic orange color.
and what's the flavor profile of it?
It is
fresh turmeric?
Not spicy like ginger. It sort of it's not going to sound good, but in a way it tastes like earth.
Sounds like a big claim.
But it works.
I used to eat mouthfuls of that when I was bullied as a child.
Yeah. So you'll be brought back.
Sends me right back to Duke Alessi kicking me in the head. Carla Music is food director for Bon Appetit magazine. She also has the best name ever.
Agreed.
Their article on food trends is in the current issue. And Duke, if you're listening, get in touch and I'll send you a dinner party download t-shirt in prison.
Wow. You're over it.
I'm sure he's there.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, coming up, Heather Haberleski, the woman behind the advice column Ask Polly, invents the single person's registry when the Dinner Party Download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, author Eric Weiner tells us about his book exploring why genius flourishes in certain places.
Our studio's covered in that, right?
Oh, totally. It's kind of a conflict of interest to even have him on the show.
We have to talk to the ombudsman.
But first, it's time for our weekly etiquette lesson.
Yes, each week you send in your questions about how to behave. And here to answer them this week is writer Heather Haberleski. Heather's sharp, sometimes salty essays and columns have regularly graced the pages of Salon, The All, and The New York Times Magazine, among other outlets. Her popular advice column, Ask Polly, now appears as part of The Cut. That's New York Magazine's culture and fashion blog. This year, she'll release her second book, which you can pre-order now. Hmm. It's called How to Be a Person in the World. And Heather, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
And likewise.
I'm a behavioral expert. I don't know if you mentioned that.
You are? Oh, we were going to get to that.
Yes.
Because your book has a modest title, How to Be a Person in the World.
Yeah.
Just hit us with that. What's the answer?
Never give brief soundbite-like answers to any question. that's rule number. That's pretty much the whole book.
That was a great soundbite you just gave us, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. So therefore, you're failing.
But for those who haven't read your column, give us an example of the kind of issues you deal with and how you approach them.
Well, the column kind of has an existential slant. So any kind of question that is multi-layered or pretty complicated about how to exist, what am I doing wrong? Often I often I respond to people who are depressed. I get a lot of my readers are very smart people who are somewhat neurotic, dare I say.
Hey, you're in the right place.
Yeah, and I can relate to these issues.
Wait, did you just call yourself smart? I think that's what just happened.
But also neurotic.
You know, most smart people are at least either a little bit neurotic or they're just working very hard to bury their
neuroses.
Sort of waking conscious emotions, yeah.
I do want to ask that, what gives you the right? Why should you be telling people how to live their life?
That's a question I ask myself almost every day as I sit down to write advice for people. My best answer is that I have made tons of mistakes over many decades.
I've been there, kind of, is your
absolutely
attitude.
And crawled my way up, and I'm still struggling. You know, I will say I definitely, from the beginning of writing this column, I had a feeling like I've been a TV critic, I've been an essayist, and this is like the thing I was born to do.
Wow.
Like, I'm just real, really, really good at this. I am.
All right.
It's like, it's so, you know, you'll see. You're going to see in just a second how good.
Well, let's see it now. Let's turn to it. So let's see how good you are, Heather Humble Haberleski. This first question comes from Jenny in Los Angeles. And Jenny writes, I'm unmarried and don't have kids, but many of my closest friends do, toddlers or younger. I've spent a small fortune on engagement gifts, wedding gifts, baby shower gifts, and while my friends don't expect or ask this of me, I admit that I also feel a little obligated to mail something for the first milestones of their kids, like their first birthday.
Wow.
But the kids are multiplying and the dollars are adding up. Is it acceptable to simply stop the gift train cold turkey?
Well, I mean, I have two kids. They're nine and six and a half. And Jenny, I'm not sure what your friends are like or how many friends you have, but I wish I had more of you in my life. The gift train for my kids, I think, stopped after the baby shower.
Really?
Yeah. I don't get gifts in the mail from or you know, handed to me from my children.
You're saying that she could just stop the gift train because she's already gone above and beyond.
She has gone way above and beyond. Come on. I mean, you know when I think you should get people gifts? I think it's important to give people gifts who never got married, never had kids,
yeah,
and they didn't cash in all those gifts that they should have gotten from those events.
Yeah, right.
I think you know, sending out an announcement and saying, it's time for my gift, that's not the best. That's not the best behavior, but I would totally send that person a gift. I'm registering.
Right.
Nothing is going on with me. You need to send me a gift.
Single person registry. Let's talk about that after this.
It'll be great.
The next question comes from Maya in Los Angeles. And Maya writes, If you're in a restaurant and your plate of food is like really delicious, is it okay to lick your plate clean at the end if the restaurant is so busy no one would notice and you're at a table with such a big party that they won't notice either? I did this until I was 26. Now I'm 28 and have stopped because I knew it wasn't proper dining etiquette, but I find it increasingly hard to resist, especially two nights ago when I had Italian.
Oh.
Yeah.
Maya, licking, I don't know how what Maya's telling herself that no one can see her licking a plate. You know, if she has some kind of invisible force field.
Yeah.
I want to know, though, does she pick the plate up to get it closer to her face?
I think that's the only way to do it.
Or does she bend over onto the plate and just shove her face into
which
the plate?
Which is better? As the mother of a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Yeah, I'm going to say, like, face planting onto the plate and maybe shielding the view with your hair, perhaps, is a little better. I just want to know why it's so hard to resist putting your tongue on a plate in a restaurant.
Like,
you gave it up for 2 years and suddenly it's back. That damned addiction.
There's bread. She's talking about an Italian restaurant. You could clean the plate
with bread.
And there'd be nothing left.
It's just not the same.
But is this another victim of the gluten-free thing? Like where
You could use a leaf of lettuce. I think what we're getting down to is don't do that.
Don't just... This is actually a very short answer. Just don't do that.
Moving on. This is from Matt in D.C. Matt asks, when attending a small get-together, it's pretty standard to bring a six-pack of beer and put it in the fridge or communal cooler. Does my beer contribution grant me access to all the beers in the collection, or is it proper etiquette to just drink the beers that I brought?
Okay, first of all, let me just say, first drink one of your beers, and then you can upgrade if you want to. It would be better if it weren't an upgrade, okay?
Yeah.
If you're bringing
I was gonna say.
Kind of middling bad beer and then you upgrade to like the really expensive beer, that's kind of not the coolest move in the world.
No.
But you can. You totally can do that. That's fine. But the best advice, I would say, is... buy some beer you want to drink and buy some beer that maybe, you know, maybe other people might want to drink it too.
Yeah, there you go.
Or you could hide your beer. That's what I used to do.
I sometimes still do that.
All right.
Yeah, totally.
If I notice that there's a lot of bad beer, you know, in a fridge.
Yeah, you just put it in the back of the fridge.
I once put some, I hid some under some lettuce.
You guys, that's the kind of advice.
Behavioral expert.
That's who we want on our show.
All right.
Heather Havrileski, thank you so much for telling our audience how to behave.
I am kind of a beacon to others, so I'm glad to share.
Heather Havrileski, she writes the Ask Polly column for New York Magazine's The Cut. Her book, How to Be a Person in the World, is coming soon. Pre-order it now.
And folks, if you have specific questions about how one should be a person, email them to us via our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now, time for Chattering Class, in which we're schooled by an expert on some party-worthy topic. The subject this week is geniuses, and specifically why certain cities at certain times in history seem to breed them.
That's right, and our guest is Eric Weiner. He is a travel writer and a former correspondent for NPR. For his new book, The Geography of Genius, he traveled the world visiting current and former, quote, genius clusters, places which at some point in history were lousy with geniuses. I first asked him about his definition of a genius, what he calls the fashionista theory.
Yeah, that's my own take on a theory that's out there. And it's the idea that a genius is someone who we declare to be a genius, you know, in much the way like, you know, you wouldn't say there's good fashion and bad fashion. There's just something is fashionable or it's not. And it changes. Genius, I believe, is a lot like that. If someone, you know, is painting a work of art and they're convinced it's the absolute best thing since Leonardo da Vinci, but no one agrees with them and no art gallery will display it, are they a genius? I would argue they're not. So genius is
really? You would argue they're not even if they are as good as Leonardo in some objective way?
Because we have to have arbiters of genius and of creativity, and that is generally us. There really isn't anything such thing as an undiscovered genius. It's a social verdict.
The wider society has to acknowledge that what you did was valuable.
Exactly. Hopefully we get it right and we choose people who produce something new and surprising and useful.
All right.
And those happen to be the three criteria for getting a U.S. patent, by the way. So
interesting.
You have to meet those three.
You started your journey in Athens, Greece, which makes sense, seat of a lot of Western thought and society. Democracy comes from Greece. I guess I was most surprised that one of your takeaways about ancient Greece is that it was chaotic and that that may have actually helped foster genius there. Because I think of it as this shining, like, giant university campus.
No, not at all. I mean, the Agora, which was the marketplace in Athens, was this hugely chaotic place where, you know, people were hawking things and there were thieves and there were storytellers and philosophers selling their oratorical skills as well. No, it was not a very orderly place at all. I mean, that's sort of the irony, because the Greeks sort of brought us rational thought, but the layout of their main city, Athens, was pretty irrational. And I do conclude that, you know, it takes a degree of disorder to make one of these genius clusters. Switzerland, well, Graham Greene famously said about the Swiss, you know, 500 years of peace and stability, and what have they brought us? The cuckoo clock.
That's right.
Which, by the way, is a German invention. So they don't even get,
they don't even get
credit for that. I know. And that's a bit harsh on the Swiss. They brought us, you know, they do some pretty good chocolate as well.
Delicious cheese.
And delicious fondue, right? Yeah, that's a form of, you know, genius. So, yeah, disorder is one of the ingredients. And Athens had it, and Florence had it, and all these places have it to some extent.
Yeah, similarly, you call your chapter about turn of the century Calcutta, genius is chaotic.
Yeah, that is the prime example of a chaotic city, if you've ever been there, yeah.
I confess, actually, that I was surprised to learn Calcutta was such a seat of invention back then, which is my Western blinders, I suppose.
Right. You know, there are different flavors of genius, and they're not just Western. There's a Chinese flavor, and there's an Indian flavor. And Calcutta in the, we're talking late 19th, early 20th century, was home of what's called the Bengal Renaissance. Scientific genius, literary genius, the world's first non-Westerner to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, a poet named Tagore. Mm. And they published more books in Calcutta at that time than any place in the world, with the exception being London. Yeah, it had its moment in the sun.
What else did you find about that city that seemed to breed brilliance?
Kind of the collision of cultures, the collision of British and Indian culture. And what was produced was not really Anglo-Indian culture. It was something entirely new. And that's almost always the case. You have all these places of genius or genius clusters. They're open to outside ideas. They're often cross currents of trade of goods. And once you're trading goods, ideas, as I say in the book, are stowaways, you know, which is why dictatorships like North Korea try very hard to restrict trade, because they know once you let the stuff in, the ideas probably can't be far behind.
This is something, by the way, I think reverberates obviously very strongly given political discussions of late, this idea that you can't have geniuses if you have closed borders.
And that, I mean, that's just empirically true. You know, one psychologist at the University of California, Davis, looked very carefully at Japan, a country that's traditionally been pretty closed.
An island, yeah.
Yeah, an island with an island mentality that they, you know, were closed to outsiders, but they would occasionally open the doors. And so he looked at Japan from, you know, roughly 500 to the year 1900, a huge swath of time, and he found a direct correlation that the more they opened their borders, the more creative brilliance you saw in all kinds of fields, in the arts and the sciences, which is, you know, not to say that, you know, immigration and open door policy doesn't lead to messiness, doesn't lead to some real problems. But I, you know, look at the roster of excellence, Einstein and Victor Hugo and Marie Curie, all immigrants and or refugees. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Was there something maybe counterintuitive that you learned in your travels that seemed to produce genius, something that you didn't expect?
Oh, it was almost all counterintuitive. For instance, these genius clusters almost always followed some catastrophe. In Florence, it was the Black Death, the bubonic plague. And then not even 50 years later, boom, you've got the Renaissance. In Edinburgh and Scotland, they were swallowed up by England, lost their independence, and then boom, Scottish Enlightenment. That was unexpected.
The reason that immediately comes to mind when you say that is that it creates a blank slate. You can kind of start over.
It shakes things up. Athenians were sacked by the Persians in the Persian War, the city of Athens was, and that allowed them to say, hey, let's rebuild it even better. And that's when they built the Acropolis. As far as geniuses themselves, the individuals, they are more likely to be an only child.
Hey, perfect for me. This explains everything.
There you go. And they're often their first names begin with the letter R. And,
crazy.
And they live in L.A. Yeah, it just...
They have radio shows?
They have radio shows and podcasts. And,
yep. Yeah. This all checks out. This feels right. Eric Weiner confirming the obvious. His book, The Geography of Genius, hit stores this week.
And folks, that concludes this episode of the Dinner Party Download. Next time, actor Tiana Paris, star of Spike Lee's latest film, Chi-Raq, stops by. Check it out.
Yes, do. Also, if you want to check us out in person, we are performing live January 28th in L.A. Our guests are Jason Schwartzman, Father John Misty, Jenny Slate, and more. Just a few tickets left. For more info, head to dinnerpartydownload.org.
People who made today's show possible include producer Jackson Musker, associate producer Nina Potok, and associate digital producer Christina Lopez. Engineering this week by Charlton Thorpe. Our interns are Carla Javier and Christian Kunz. Larissa Anderson is our executive producer. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Bon appétit.